Well, hello everyone. Today we're going to be looking at the Russians, a country that's been in the news quite a lot over the past couple of years. And this is continuing my series, reading from Andrei Siegfried's The Character of Peoples. We are up to chapter 6, and it's called Russian Mysticism. This ought to be interesting, of course, because we've heard so much about the Russians, and they're still somewhat impenetrable to us. Everybody's, you know, talked about Alexander Dugin and thought about, you know, what Putin is thinking and so on. But still, we're kind of out of doors when it comes to the Russians. So I'm very interested to see what Siegfried talks about here, and also how, to what extent, his notes match up with the famous essay by Oswald Spengler, where he talks about the two faces of the Russians, one of them pointing for facing west towards Europe, and one of them facing east towards Asia. This has been a perennial question in kind of the camp, you know, how we think of the Russians, or how the Russians think of themselves, even. And it remains a question today. I mean, from what I know of Dugin, he has talked about Eurasianism. And, you know, if you think about Putin's own trajectory, he initially tried to align himself with the West, and then he felt rebuffed, or, you know, in his own mind, in his own narrative, he felt rejected or rebuffed or betrayed, and then has started to turn towards China, the Middle East, and indeed the East in general. So this is I'm interested to see if any of these themes come up in Siegfried, who, in all the other chapters, has started with questions of geography, you know, primarily. I mean, I think Siegfried was a kind of a geographer, or I think he had that in his background. So that's one of the reasons why it's been so prominent. Anyway, before we get started, I'll just remind people, pick up the Trivium. I should be doing some stuff related to logic and rhetoric to this week. But if you're interested, that's the best-selling course there. Foundations of Shakespeare is the most recent course that has sold pretty well as well. Obviously, I'm a world expert in Shakespeare. I wrote 5 books on Shakespeare, and possibly a 6th one based on this as well, forthcoming. So pick that up as well if you want to know anything there is to know about Shakespeare, free of any woke nonsense, obviously. All right, so let's get a move on then with Siegfried. He starts. The remote breath of the East penetrates serendipitously as far as Germany, and in Russia herself, Asia is already present, though they say Europe extends as far as the Urals. More than anywhere else in the world, psychology here depends on geography. Well, there we are. He's already started with his geography talk. 3 characteristics mark the land of Russia: its immensity, its uniformity, and its lack of natural defenses against invasion, and at the same time, its impenetrability. The distances are enormous. European Russia has an area of over 2 million square miles. European Russia and Asiatic Russia together have an area of over 8 million square miles. From Libau on the Baltic to Vladivostok on the Pacific, the distance is 5,000 miles. The Soviet Union is by far the biggest country in the world. Remember, of course, Siegfried writing in 1952, so the USSR was still there. Now, even though they've lost territory since then, Russia is still absolutely enormous and the biggest country in the world by some distance, even today. Anyway, let's continue. The distances the Russian have to reckon with are so vastly greater than ours that no comparison is possible. France, with her 2,000 and 25,000 square miles, would go 10 times into European Russia alone. That's another thing. If you're new to this series, Siegfried, despite his name, he sounds like a German, right? but he is French. André Siegfried is French. So when he says we and us, he's typically referring to the French. Okay. The distance from Paris to Vienna is something over 600 miles. But what is that compared to the astronomic figures which place Russia in the same class with the vast North European continents rather than with our molehills? Our normal estimate of distances is lost in that immensity. Geographically, we are well out of Europe already, and the uniformity of the landscape increases the difficulty of measurement. Europe is essentially diverse, divided up and articulated, but for thousands of miles, the Russian countryside is the same. After one white plain, another white plain, says the poet. It is an almost limitless territory, empty, monotonous, and unbroken, in short, a continent of elemental proportions. In this amorphous immensity, without frontier and without barriers, nature has provided no sort of defense against invasion, so that throughout history, and no doubt in the prehistoric period as well, invasion after invasion has rolled across it like a tidal wave. And each wave has left layers of human beings behind, as a real flood leaves alluvial deposits. The result has been a kind of ethnic patchwork. Successive human contributions have pushed against each other, superimposed themselves on the preceding layers, mingled with them, so that the dominant ethnic impression is one of complexity. Nevertheless, the essential unity of the country is incontestable. Geography, the climate, and the general environment have imposed a certain way of life, a certain manner of reacting to circumstances, a certain sort of feeling, which are common to all Russians. They represent a great group of the human race, characterized above all by a common social atmosphere. Foreigners visiting Russia are soon made strongly aware of the individuality of this atmosphere. Some of them resist it. Others, and there have been many of them, let themselves succumb willingly to its undoubted attractions. We may therefore conclude that despite geographical and ethnic differences, there is beyond all question a Russian country, a Russian people, and a Russian attitude, which includes a way of life, a rhythm of living, and an essential atmosphere, something one might call the Russian ambient. The question is often asked whether it is Europe or Asia. It is really something in between, something which is not completely European and not altogether Asiatic. And such terms as Eurasia and the Sixth Continent, often illuminating and by no means wholly inaccurate, have been coined to meet the difficulty. You see, so he's already talking about what I was wondering if he'd talk about. Indeed, nowadays, statisticians are growing more and more accustomed to putting the Soviet Union in a class apart in the way they deal with a separate continent. Where is the dividing line? Where does it cease to be Western and begin to be no longer entirely European, but Asiatic, yet not altogether Asiatic either? For myself, I place the line at the frontier of Central Europe, somewhere in the great glacial plain, which extends from North Germany to Poland. No one has described the transition better than Luc Durtain, and he does it in the following significant lines. This is Durtain now. Lodz against a bright sky which dazzles your eyes, stands out a forest of smoking chimneys, the famous spinning mills. But the people gathered on the quay are new to you. Men in top boots, Jews in stained caftans, wearing flat top caps with peaks like a black fingernail. Women whose heads and shoulders are covered with bright shawls. it is not long before their costumes and their faces make you feel you are in unfamiliar surroundings. You find a certain strangeness amongst all these people, which at first you have difficulty in defining. Above all, they seem to be there just because they are. Their attitude is not Germanic obedience. It is something quite different, something resigned and passive, yet faces, detached looks, a sort of Eastern contemplativeness. And then on the horizon, behind you, the 1,000 chimney stacks of Lodz fade into the distance. Give them a last glance, because on your whole journey throughout Poland, all day and 300 miles long, you will not see another dozen all told, apart from the modest industrial suburbs of Warsaw. And take a good look at that road, made of pointed stones, which looks so primitive to you. For 300 miles, you will not find another one to match it. Nothing but tracks, with here and there a cart with solid wheels, looking as though it had come from old Merovingian chronicle, determinedly negotiating the mud and crossing the marshland. Suddenly you realize why all the people here wear top boots. And did you notice the occasional decrepit motor car rolling along the road? Today you will see fewer and fewer motor cars and fewer factories. What is it you are meeting here in the form of this Slav immensity? It is the earth itself, not yet conquered and in elemental proportions. If you have not yet made the acquaintance of the Sahara or the prairie states of the West, you are experiencing the same sort of thing for the first time today. That's the end of the quote. This is Siegfried again. These observations are penetrating. They are worthy of careful consideration, particularly because they underline the fact that we are dealing here with a frontier, not of a country, but a continent. The industrialization of Russia by the Soviets has not fundamentally changed the situation. It may even be that under the regime, which has been established by the Iron Curtain, the atmosphere of the East has advanced still further towards us. It was 100 years ago that the Marquis de Custine, a keen and penetrating observer of Russia, in the 19th century wrote, "There is a great wall of China set up between Russia and France. Despite the Russian pretensions inspired by Peter the Great, Serbia begins on the Vistula." Could we not say the same today of the Oder and perhaps even of the Elbe? Once we leave the former frontiers of the Roman Empire, of the Empire of Charlemagne, behind us, do we not get the impression that Europe, authentic Europe, ends very rapidly? The influence of the Russian climate is decisive here. We know its main characteristics. It is essentially continental, that is to say, it goes to extremes, very hot in summer and very cold in winter. Oceanic influences hardly extend as far as the shores of the Baltic, and then only in a diminished form. Continental aspect is all the more marked when one travels, not so much from the south to the north as from the west to the east. But wherever you go, it is cold. Very cold indeed, for a long time. Here are 8 to 10 months of frost in the north, the east and the southeast, and 3 to 5 months even in the south. How do we classify such a climate? It is not properly related to the climate of Western Europe, which is Atlantic, or to that of the Mediterranean Europe, except perhaps sometimes in the Crimea. Its real relationship lies more with the climate of the land masses of Asia, China, Tibet, Anatolia. It is a country with a harsh climate from which men suffer, and nature does not show herself in any benevolent light. That is a factor which should not be overlooked in any discussion of Russia. I'll just pause here to say one of the things that Siegfried has done continuously throughout this book is emphasize not only the geography, but the climate and the weather patterns and how they impact on the mentality of the people. It's a really fascinating way of thinking about people and places and cultures. Anyway, I'll continue. The ethnic formation of the Russian people has come about primarily by two series of invasions which have superimposed human layers on an already existing native stock. The native races include, in the forests of the north, nomadic Finns, hunters and fishers who belong by their skeletal structure, their complexion and their dialectics to the Mongolian races of Asia. To the south, in the steppes, there are also nomad populations leading a pastoral life. They too are Mongolian and are of Asiatic character. The main subsequent contribution is that of the Slavs, which dates from before the Christian era. These white Aryans, who came, it is supposed, from Iran, established themselves in the steppes, settled down, and began to till the land. They consist of three main groups: the Russians, the Poles, and the Lithuanians. And the Russian group is further subdivided into three: the Great Russians in the center, in the Moscow region, the Little Russians in the Black Earth territory of Ukraine, and the White Russians in the west, on the borders of Poland. These divisions are all readily recognizable today. All subsequent invasions after the dawn of the Christian era were of Asiatic origin. The human stock brought in this fashion was not Slav. It consisted of hordes of Mongolians, who were first pagans and then Muslims. There were the Huns of Attila, the tribesmen of Genghis Khan in the 12th century, and then finally the Golden Horde in the 15th century. And they all subjected great areas of the land and settled there. The work of the Tsars pushed back that wave, persistently pressing forward from the east to the west. The Tsars reconquered Russia politically, first from the Mongols, then from the Slavs, who were not Russians, and finally they conquered Asia itself. The Slavs represent the core of the Russian people. But there is a big Tatar element, and there are also numerous allogeneous elements. The Jews, for example, the German and Lutheran Balts on the shores of the Baltic, who have since been eliminated. The German colonies, which recently existed in the southwest as distinct entities. The Turks, various Caucasian tribes, and still others. However, when we come to weigh up the proportions of these diverse elements in the total population, it becomes quite clear that the Slav element is by far the most important. The Tatars, although they are still a notable element to the east of the Volga, remain of secondary importance. And then we must also take into account certain outlying populations which have come under Russian influence, which are themselves capable at the same time of influencing the national psychology of Russia. Thus we find that Russia is surrounded by a series of marches which make it impossible to trace the frontiers of properly Russian civilization with any degree of certainty. We must first keep the fact clearly in mind that in the center of this vast amorphous body there is a people properly Russian, and that people is itself immense. It is Asiatic by origin, geography and neighboring relations, but nevertheless it is related to quite a considerable extent to the West, thanks to a long association with European history. From Byzantium, this people has received a strong taste for subtle discussion, a finesse pushed sometimes to the length of deceit. a certain something which suggests overdevelopment rather than youth, which is in strong contrast with the primitive and even barbarian characteristics which are also to be found in the same people. Under Uzbek, writes the Marquis de Custine, the Russians paid tribute to the Mohammedans, but at the same time they continue to receive from the Greek Empire, as they did in the beginning, its arts, its manners, its science, its religion, its politics, with their tradition of cunning and deceit, and its aversion for Latin influences. It was from Europe, but from Eastern Europe, and in the form of evangelical orthodoxy, that Russia received her Christian tradition, whilst Catholicism, the successor of Rome, was given the West, or has given the West, a new sense of law and order. Eastern evangelicism, less shaped and nearer to the original simplicity of Christianity, has given the Russian traits of goodness and charity, which do not always go with justice and moral rectitude, but which nevertheless evoke to a much greater extent than they do in Germany what Shakespeare called the milk of human kindness. It is also from Europe that Russia, from the days of Peter the Great to those of Lenin and Stalin, has borrowed all her modern technique. She has absorbed it passionately and in a spirit which is more mystical than mechanical. But despite all these acquired contributions, and despite the high level of civilization they demand, barbarism is just under the surface, all the time, as though the assimilation has not been complete, or had been periodically arrested by a return to primitive origins. Russia, wrote the Marquis de Custine, is today in the 19th century, hardly 400 years removed from the days of barbarian invasions, whilst the West went through the same crisis 14 centuries ago. A civilization which is 1,000 years older puts an incomparable distance between the manners and morals of nations. But one way or the other, the Russian people are conscious of their identity as a people and of their national unity itself, which is based not on race, because they are not racialists, but on a certain conception of life which is common to them, and on a common physical and moral atmosphere. As has often been said, there is something mystic in the idea they hold of themselves and of their destiny. The Russian people cannot disappear, Gorky makes one of his vagabonds say. It is written in the Bible. Do you know the Russian people? They are immense. How many villages there are on Russian soil? They live everywhere, this great and real people. And you say they will disappear? A people cannot die. A man can die, but God has need of a people. We translate these lines into modern terms. They will help us understand the immense confidence the Soviet people have in their future. When we speak of Russian psychology, it is difficult to define any permanent characteristics. On the one hand, we can distinguish an initial fund inherited from a long-distant Asiatic past. But on the other, we must not overlook the brutal attempt at westernization carried out by Peter the Great, or the profound upheaval of the whole country brought about in the name of Western technique by the Soviet Revolution. In such circumstances, it is not easy to distinguish characteristics which are properly Russian, and there is some danger that we may regard them as Sovietic. On the other hand, characteristics which we regard as properly Russian may well be Sovietic in reality. It is equally difficult to know whether certain or recent transformations brought about by the revolution of 1917 are only temporary, or whether they are destined to last. It is quite clear that the Bolshevist revolution has rejuvenated the Russian people, but to what extent the Russian people have been rejuvenated, certainly, but one could also contend at the same time that they had been Easternized, the old Asiatic element is rising to the surface today to a much greater extent than before. Let us see first of all that what there really is Eastern, sorry, let us see first of all what there really is Eastern and Asiatic in the Russian. His psychology is profoundly influenced by the proximity of and by contact with Asia. And yet words like proximity and contact are inadequate. It is the presence of Asia making itself felt everywhere that we must take into account. What sort of Asia is it with which we must deal? It is not the Asia Minor of the Mediterranean Levant. Sorry, is it? Yes, it is not the Asia Minor of the Mediterranean Levant, which we know so well and which extends its influence to our shores, even in our own Riviera, but the Asia of the great landmass further east, Mongolian Asia, and that is quite a different matter. It has often been said that the Russian is a Westerner influenced by Asia, but it would be truer to say that he is an Asiatic influenced by the West, perhaps even to some extent thrown off his balance by the West. In this respect, the words of Bismarck, who was his German ambassador to Petersburg, got to know the country very well. And the words that Bismarck said are illuminating. So this is what Bismarck said. The Russian has nothing to do with the West. He will succeed only in catching all its sicknesses. One of the most Asiatic characteristics of the Russians is in his great patience, his endurance, his capacity to suffer. He is not only capable of resisting suffering, he is also not upset at finding life so hard, even cruel. This attitude is itself the result of long suffering and tribulation imposed on him by the climate in which he lives, by invasions and by the tradition of cruelty which has marked all history in that part of the world. All his sufferings have, in the end, come to present themselves to his mind as natural because he has suffered them always. He has come to accept them realistically and even without protest as one accepts the manifestations of force, thus also the diktats of the state. Perhaps he thinks about them, but he submits and bows his neck as though the forces, as though before the forces of nature herself. That is the sense of his famous Nichevo, the genitive of the pronoun nichto, which means nihil, nothing. Nichtevo, nichevo, he says repeatedly. It's of no consequence, it doesn't matter. And in his heart of hearts, he consoles himself with the thought that despite all, he will survive. That is certainly an Oriental philosophy inculcated by centuries of suffering. The inarticulate nature of Russian political life, both today and in the past, is explained in this way. It always seems that apart from the pronouncements of whoever is leader at the time, nothing happens at all. Nothing ever happens. I wonder where we heard that before. Interesting. In his Histoire de l'Europe Contemporaine, Sennebo makes the following comment in his chapter on Russia. This is Sennebo or Sennebos. He says, it would be difficult to give the political history of the Russian Empire a space proportionate to the importance of Russia. Thanks to its autocratic constitution, the empire has been kept apart from the happenings from which form the basis of contemporary political life. Like the absolute monarchies of the 18th century, Russia has hardly any other history but that of its sovereigns and their courts, and this we know primarily by the versions given by opponents of the government and published abroad, which it is impossible to check except by what appears in official publications. And these teach us nothing of real life in the country. That is why the domestic history of Russia, except during the attempts at reform carried out under Alexander II, receive less space than the repressive measures adopted by the government against its enemies, Poles, dissidents, or revolutionaries. These lines were written more than a quarter of a century ago of a regime which then lay more than 100 years back, but they could equally well be applied to the Russia of our own day. And funny enough, I'm reading this in this was written in 1952. I'm reading it in 2025, and I'm sure many people would say the same thing about Putin's regime today, right? Not a czar, not a communist, but Putin's Russia is still autocratic in that way. This capacity of the Russian masses to suffer does not necessarily indicate pessimism or fatalism. On the contrary, we must recognize the optimism, the dynamism, and the confidence which characterized Russia under the Soviets, and above all, the absence of any feeling of inferiority. A vigorous minority has played the role of yeast in the great mass. However, in the big towns, at least, the mass of Russians certainly gives the observer an impression of passivity, something like that to be met with in India, but not at all like that in China. It is the East already, but not the Far East and not the West either. Not sure how modern Russians would like to be compared to the Indians, but there we go. This combination of Eastern and Western influences has brought about a certain undeniable lack of balance. There has always been something fantastic and excessive about the Russian, owing to the lack of fusion between contradictory elements. What we said earlier on of Germany is even more definitively the case in Russia. The synthesis has not been achieved, and it is in this sense that the Russian is not civilized and mature to the same extent as we are. In the same Russian, we find existing side by side humility and pride, idealism and cynicism, virtue and vice, and he goes from one to the other abruptly and without transition, with extraordinary facility. In reading the Russian novel, and in particular Dostoevsky, we constantly come up against this contradiction. And today, at international conferences, we find the same characteristics, contradictory and extreme, among the Soviet representatives. They find it easy to combine charm and brutality, amiability and rudeness, suppleness and violence, and we never know how to take them or in which mood they are going to be next. Sometimes they are diplomats with engaging manners, and at other times they behave like Merovingians strayed into the 20th century. It suggests that the Russian has missed stage in his psychological development between the Middle Ages and modern society, between barbarism and divinity, or to borrow the style of Pascal, between the beast and the angel. The Marquis de Castine also noticed the trait. Physically, the climate of this country, morally, its government, devour in the bud of everything which is weak. Russia is a country of wild passions or weak characters, of revolts or automatons. There is no middle thing here between the tyrant and the slave, between the fool and the animal. The golden mean is unknown. Extraordinary. The Russian individuality is made up of these disparate elements, and we cannot even say they are contemporary elements. Even under the czars, Russia built up a mechanized industry with the latest technique. But its labor power, recruited in the surrounding countryside, was still medieval. Today, the official outlook is completely materialist. But at the same time, Stalin is practically a god, just as Augustus was for the Romans. Bolshevism is expansionist, desiring to play the role of the universal apostle of a social doctrine. But at the same time, it surrounds the country with an impenetrable Great Wall of China. In the old days, we knew grand signors from Moscow whose polished manners were incomparable and yet slept in their boots. The diplomatic corps in general and the Westerners in general have always been considered as envious and malevolent spies by this government with its Byzantine spirit and by Russia as a whole, wrote Marquis de Custine. Whoever crosses the Russian frontier, whether under Nicholas II or Stalin, immediately feels himself surrounded by an atmosphere of suspicion, as though he really were an envious and malevolent spy. Like a stranger in Moscow. Do you remember that song? That was Michael Jackson's song. I'm thinking of Tucker Carlson. I'm weirdly thinking of Tucker Carlson when he went there. Anyway, let's carry on. On the eve of the First World War, I'd love to know if Endeavor or any of the other friends of ours who've actually been to Russia, what they make of these descriptions and whether modern Russia is the same or whether it's changed. I'd love to know. Anyway, on the eve of the First World War, one of our ambassadors wanted to make a tour of inspection of Russian industries, but the Petersburg government regarded the proposal with the utmost disfavor. I don't think our representatives in Moscow would even dream of such an enterprise. The fact is that the Soviets, technical disciples of the West, distrust the West and are bottom detested. One could go even further. The Russian, whether czarist or revolutionary, has always regarded the basis of Western civilization as being morally bad from his point of view. And where he adopts it, he is filled with a sort of remorse. Even when he accepts Western civilization, he does not adopt its principles, and he never feels himself thoroughly at home and settled in it. The idea of private property, which is the basis of all individuality, exists amongst the Russians as it exists everywhere, but it has never existed with them as a firm conviction. Even before the Russian Revolution, it caused the Russian scruples, remorse, as though there was something morally wrong in owning things. A Russian who grows rich, does business, and accumulates wealth is always regarded somewhat distrustfully as a none too honest person, though this has, incidentally, never prevented Russians from hunting after riches, just like any other human beings. The late Nicholas Berdyaev says much the same thing in his Nouveau Moyen Age. This is this Berdyaev. He says, at all times, the Russian people were animated by a spirit of detachment from earthly things, unknown to the peoples of the West. And it is this which characterizes them. They have never felt themselves attached or bound to the things of this world, to property, the family, the state, to its rights, to its possessions, to its outward mode of life. If the Russian people are bound to the earth, it is by sin. The Russians are probably less honest, in short, less correct, than the Western peoples. But the latter are bound by their very virtues to this earthly life and to the good things of this world. For a Western European, property is sacred, and he is not prepared to let himself be robbed of his own without a bitter struggle. He has adopted an ideology which justifies his attachment to the good things of this world. A Russian, even when he is a slave to the vices of cupidity and avarice, does not consider private property sacred, and he has no ideological justification for his possession of worldly goods. And in his heart of hearts, he thinks that he would do better to don the penitential garb and go on a pilgrimage. The Russian landed proprietor was never fully convinced that he owned his land by right. Similarly, the Russian merchant was quite convinced that his fortune, often obtained by doubtful means, was not pure, and that sooner or later he would have to do penance. Fundamentally, almost all Russians regard bourgeois society as sinful. This outlook lacks neither inspiration nor grandeur, but at the same time it is obvious, and it is very far removed, from the constructive Puritanism of the Anglo-Saxon and from the achievements which have made Europe's greatness from the days of the Renaissance, even from the Middle Ages. Such an outlook is much more in the evangelical tradition. Whilst adopting Western technique, the Russian has not effaced his previous outlook, and I believe that today the Bolshevist honestly regards us as corrupt. He combines in himself, in the curious fashion, the traits of a sort of Middle Ages and those of a mechanical age. We are acquainted with the splendid religious sentiment of Tolstoy, and he is representative. There is nothing in it of the pantheism we meet in Germany, but a mystical idealism embracing the spirit of sacrifice, devotion, and social apostolate. With the way in which a militant communist talks about a tractor owes something to mysticism, it is no use his telling us aggressively and repeatedly that he is a materialist and nothing but a materialist. Just compare his language, his attitude, and his passion with the pragmatic and earthy efficiency of the American businessman working out his costs of production. Thus, Russian talents are striking and their inadequacies notorious. The Russian people are gifted, more gifted, for example, than the German, whose efficiency we discussed earlier on. They are conscientious, willing, and disciplined. In Russia, at every step, we meet vivacity, spontaneity, and fantasy. In short, the creative spirit. Whether it is a question of artistic or religious invention, the Russian is a creative artist, but judged by our Western standards, his achievement is mediocre. That becomes understandable when we consider the fundamental and incorrigible irregularity of daily life in Russia, where time seems to have no more bounds than the steps themselves. The Russian is a bohemian. He has no sense of time. His meals are not taken at fixed times. When you think of the almost sacred character of the midday meal for the ordinary man in France, you will get the same idea of the great distance which separates Paris from Moscow. The vagueness of time in an ordinary Russian day is positively frightening by comparison with the bourgeois regularity of our own. No doubt the whole atmosphere contributes to it. And when you have once lived in Russia, if only for a few days, you very quickly get used to the rising late, to breakfasting when the sun is already past its zenith, and going to bed when it is almost on the point of rising again. It seems that organized life as we know it has never firmly established itself in a society which does not depend on the clock. Russians have not to the movements of the sun as we are. They are not related to the movements of the sun as we are. And they show signs of persistent nomadism, which seems inherited throughout the centuries. People are at home on a journey, on a pilgrimage, and it is symbolic that Tolstoy died far away from his home in a little country backwater. Only yesterday, the Russian peasant lived a medieval existence, using the tools of the 13th century and calculating and measuring only with difficulty. However, this sort of thing had nothing to do with any congenital inferiority of Russian civilization. It was simply an age-old backwardness, which is naturally difficult to make good. Certain customs are, in fact, those of Asiatic collectivism. The conditions in which Russians live, particularly since the revolution, with their overpopulated towns, appall us. But we should remember that the Russians do not suffer so much from this close cohabitation as a Frenchman would. They are used to living one on top of the other, to camping out anywhere, in a railway station, in the anteroom, or in a salon. I remember a Russian family installing themselves in the sleeping compartment next to mine on the train. The samovar bubbled, a hammock was suspended from the ceiling for the baby, and all the equipment of a camp was unpacked. I had the impression that they had put up a tent. When we travel east, leaving our civilized West behind us, it is by such signs that we recognize the approach of Asia. The Russians have a talent for and a sense of human relations. Their discussions are endless. They go on infinitely, indefinitely, without necessarily arriving at any conclusions. They have been dismissed as mere idle gossip that is not always unfair. Faced with such an avalanche of words, the government redresses things by strict orders and merciless discipline. That is necessary with the people inclined to pose problems in the absolute, citing a flood of technical evidence but very often up in the clouds and no account of time. This combination explains well enough the spirit and the methods of the present regime. In its achievements, we find a magnificent devotion to the cause, a real passion to some extent mystical, but at the same time an excessive accumulation of technical notes and figures, a diplomatic suppleness which is astonishing, and a patience which is truly oriental. But in the end, if we compare the results obtained with the effort exerted, we find that the result is feeble. Feeble enough. The contradiction, which it's, I mean, I have to say, I've come to quite enjoy his French snobbiness. He just comes out and says it in a way that no writer today would, French or otherwise, I think. It's kind of refreshing to see this, like, this level of kind of Gallic arrogance, I guess. But anyway, let's continue. The contradiction, which shows itself again and again in all these traits, comes above all from a retarded evolution towards civilization. It remains one of a statue which is only just beginning to take shape from the block of stone, roughly quarried and elementary. The Russian is human, more so than the German. He is capable of a spirit of tolerance, of charity, and of pity. In everyday life, he is simple and engaging, with many qualities similar to our own. A crowd is not disagreeable, or a hostile crowd. It even gives you an impression of friendliness towards the stranger. But on the other hand, and the conclusion is impossible to avoid, our soldiers and our prisoners in Russian knew it only too well. The Russian people are brutal, savage, given to drink, and they have little respect for human life. They leave us with a terrifying impression of a horde of Tartars rolling across Europe. The entry of Russian troops into Vienna and Berlin was like a repetition of the invasions of Attila. And I have to say that this, he's saying this, and you say, well, okay, these impressions are dated, they're from 1952 and so on. I would say that the European reaction to the Russians, to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, to the prospect of Russian invasion, has never changed. Whether you read Lord Palmerston and Mackinder, whether you read this stuff, or whether you just look at the comments of Macron and Starmer and our politicians now, largely supported by the public, I have to say as well, those of us who've dissented have been in the very small minority on that question. The impression is the same. They are always seen as the outside horde, the Mongol horde, the barbarian invasion, you know, just terror, almost an irrational fear, I would say, of the Russian. Well, you could say, is it irrational? I mean, they do have a history of invading in this way. So yeah, I would say that even though the language may have changed, the actual kind of primal instinct is the same from Western Europe. Let us compare the Russian with the German. The German, passive and disciplined, inserts himself into a sort of armor, which he needs as a man with a weak spine, needs an orthopedic corset. The Russian is also passive, but at the same time, more spontaneous. He submits to an armor equally authoritarian. It does not even surprise him, because he believes that it is and always was the way of things. For the Russian, technique is a faith. For the German, it is second nature. Asia has pushed forward its tentacles into the Elbe. It is present in Moscow. The West has deceived itself astonishingly about Russia, and France in particular about Tsarist Russia. At the time of the Russian alliance, we harboured illusions, but the facade, though imposing, was deceptive. We were full of admiration, I remember, for an authority which was not afraid to affirm itself, for splendid uniforms like those of the Germans, worn by impressive giants, and we thought we were face to face with a replica of those efficient and powerful Prussians who had defeated us in 1871. But behind it all, there was not the order, the industry, or the seriousness of the Germans. Despite its impressive exterior, it was really more a decadent and corrupt Oriental tyranny, and it was an anarchical, despite its outward appearance. Bismarck did not deceive himself, and even before becoming chancellor, he had seen through it all and recognized the original weakness of the whole system. The collapse of the imperial regime in 1917 ought not to have surprised us. Today, a new Russia has risen from the ruins, and in some respects, it seems the old Russia. Perhaps we are wrong to believe that the change is fundamental, because the essential characteristics, which we have been at some pains to extract, still persist. The youth of the regime hides certain faults and enhances certain undeniable qualities. But were not those qualities already present, and have those faults really been corrected? And I reckon exactly the same points and questions can be made about Russia today, vis-a-vis Stalin's Russia. And this is one of those really interesting facets of Putin's own thinking. I mean, I mentioned Tucker Carlson. When we watched the interview with Putin and on Tucker, he's really keen, and Dugin is the same, to stress the essential continuity of Russian history between the Tsarists, the communists or the Bolsheviks, and modern day Russia. He wants to tell a continuous story going back to 700 AD. So this actually backs up what Siegfried was saying here in 1952. And I also wonder if exactly the same questions could be saying, like, has Russia really changed from the Soviet Union to now, or from Tsarist Russia to now? Good question. I don't know. I do not want to be paradoxical, but I believe that apart from those books from which we form our opinions of Russia, those of Anatole Leroy Beaulieu and of the Marquis de Custine, for example, we should be wrong to neglect certain others, which are not unknown, perhaps, but are not taken seriously enough. I am not thinking of Mikhail Strogoff in the case of A Poor Guide, but of the works of Comtesse de Ségur, Nostofine. I can't say that. I mean, that's just a jumble of letters. I'll spell it for you. Rostopchine. I can't say that. Come on. Anyway, let us remember how many properly Asiatic traits there are in these stories for children. Traits which please the children particularly by a fund of primitiveness or realism. And let us use the word cynicism hidden behind a screen of parental moralism. Some of the punishments inflicted on Sophie are of Tartar sadism. And with Le General Durakin, we are translated into the very heart of Russia. Does not the banquet described in Le Rube de Langardien remind us of those sumptuous and giant banquets with which Soviet hosts are so fond of astonishing their Western visitors? And finally, let us not overlook the fact that the propaganda of the Stalinist regime affects to identify its origin not in the bourgeois and decadent Russia of Nicholas II, but in the mighty Russia of Peter the Great. And there ends the chapter, a little bit of a shorter chapter today on Russia, but extremely interesting. And I mean, I do recognize, I have not encountered many Russians myself. I've only been to Russia once when I went to Moscow airport, and all I noticed was that all of the computers, this was kind of in the early 2000s, all the computers looked really 80s, like really old-fashioned computers, and the women were like very, Amazonian, kind of like 6-foot-tall women who looked like they could knock you out in uniforms. You know, that's all I really remember from Moscow airport, and that's the only time I've even been anywhere close to Russia. So, and I was in transit, so I didn't even get to see it. So I don't really have, my impressions of Russia really are from the news, from a meeting like characters like Putin and Dugin and Lavrov and people like this. So I don't really have as much knowledge of these people. You know, I've met French and Germans, you know, in my career and life and so on, not met many Russians. So I'd love to know how much truth there is in this. From what I can gather and from what I've seen, I recognize a lot of it. I do recognize a lot of it just from what I've seen in the news and so on. All right. I'd love to know what you know in the comments. I've decided, I mean, I was thinking of canceling this series after the German episode didn't get as many views as previous ones, but I've enough people persuaded me to continue to the bitter end. So we've just got the Americans left next week, and then an essay on the destiny of Western civilization to finish up in 2 weeks' time, and I will finish up. Just remind people, pick up Trivium today, and I'll catch you tomorrow for office hours. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.